Welcome to Business on the Brink, a production from iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. When last we left off, the Radio Corporation of America, or RCA, had just become the RCA Corporation. So I guess it was the Radio Corporation of America Corporation.
President David Sarnoff was relying on a combination of innovations and ruthless business strategy to tune in to success.
Ultimately, RCA would grow into an enormous company with its proverbial fingers in many proverbial pies.
Yum pie. Until the mid-1980s, when another company would put a stop to it. This is RCA in Business on the Brink.
Hey, everyone. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Ariel.
And we're going to continue our story with RCA, as we mentioned. So if you have not heard the previous episode, you should probably go do that.
Yep.
Because it will set the stage for what is about to happen. But we had just talked about how RCA had become its own independent company after being sort of a mutual partnership among many big, big companies like General Electric and Westinghouse.
And we left off in the year 1932.
Yeah. So we're going to jump to 1934 because this is when one of RCA's properties, NBC, the at that point, the radio network, it was before TV networks, was the subject of some scrutiny. The Mutual Broadcasting System said that NBC and CBS were essentially a duopoly, that these two networks of radio stations were making it very difficult if you wanted to operate, say, an independent radio station. And the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, said, yeah. So they went up to NBC, which technically was two radio networks, the Red Network and the Blue Network, and said, here's the deal. You got to get rid of one of them. You got to sell one of these off.
Yeah, pick your favorite child.
Yeah. And RCA said, I'm gonna appeal this. And the appeals court said, yeah, you got to do it. So RCA said, I'm going to take this to the Supreme Court. And Supreme Court said, yeah, you got to do it.
Yeah. In the meanwhile, RCA kept business going.
Yeah, it was no longer tied to General Electric or Westinghouse. The Great Depression was still going on. But David Sarnoff, the leader of the company, was still trying to innovate and also still trying to use any kind of business method whatsoever to keep competition well under his heel.
Yeah, but one of the things he was still trying to push was this TV, right?
Yeah, he had been behind the idea of electronic television since really the 20s and had been funding it directly since 1930. And in 1939, so after about a decade of research and development, they debuted an electronic television at the 1939 World's Fair. They actually showed a live broadcast of U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Was he drinking a PBR?
He was not. That was different World's Fair. That was in the 1800s. But he was giving an address live. And in fact, this was a live broadcast. So live from camera broadcast to this television. And they began, RCA, the company, to manufacture television sets.
Giant ones, like 60 inches.
Divide that by five.
12 inches.
There you go. 12-inch TVs. The screen was 12 inches. The television sets were enormous.
Giant.
Yeah.
It
was a piece of furniture.
All those tubes in the back.
These were big. This was before the transistor, so very large pieces of equipment. And, of course, just like we talked about in the last episode, you got to have stuff to show on your thing or nobody's going to buy it.
So they showed a baseball game, right?
They did, between Columbia University and Princeton.
Who won?
Princeton, 2-1. So
not a bad game.
Yeah. You got to think that Sarnoff was probably proud of that because the other university had the word Columbia in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And RCA and the company Columbia were constantly bickering with one another, fighting for domination.
And then they showed a Major League Baseball game after that, right?
Yep, November of 1939. It was actually a doubleheader between two teams, the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds. Each team won one of those games. So if you were a fan of Cincinnati or a fan of the Brooklyn Dodgers, you were able to be happy at least half the time. Then the networks like NBC and CBS were getting into television, trying to push this, but it's hard getting a brand new technology mm-hmm. off the ground, especially one that was as expensive as televisions. Early TVs were, I mean, they were prohibitively expensive for the vast majority of consumers out there. And on top of that, even when the Great Depression was going to start to come to an end, something else was starting to boil up, and that something else was the Second World War.
Now, World War II.
Yeah, World War II. That would be it. That's the one. So yeah, they called World War I the war to end all wars, and then I guess World War II was, oops, I did it again.
Brittany!
Yeah, leave Brittany alone. So RCA's consumer electronics business would slow down during this time, but there was money to be made because, as it turns out, when a war is on, the military needs lots of stuff.
See, I thought you were going to say, when the war is on, the TV's on.
Well, it would have been, but there was no TV yet. So, at least not really. So, instead, RCA would start to develop technology for the military. Now, most of the time, it was like components that would go into larger things, like radar systems and stuff.
Okay.
So they were really focusing on that. A lot of the manufacturing power of the United States was being dedicated to wartime efforts. This was across the board. If you operated a factory, chances are you were trying to land military government contracts, because otherwise you couldn't even get the raw materials you needed to make your stuff.
Yeah.
Because the U.S. would put, you know, very strict limitations on that.
Everything was going to the war efforts.
Yes, yes. And so at this time, also during World War II, the FCC ruling would come down in 1943, and RCA would have to split up those NBC networks, the Red and Blue Network. So a guy named Edward J. Noble, we're going to have to do an episode about Edward J. Noble at some point.
Got it. Noted.
He had made a fortune with Lifesavers, not the flotation device.
The candy.
The candy, Lifesavers. He was a Lifesaver's fortune guy.
Lifesavers were his lifesaver.
Mm-hmm. He made a lot of money on those Lifesavers. So he would buy the Blue Network from NBC for the princely sum of $8 million.
Not too shabby.
Nope. And then a couple years later, he would rebrand that network so that its official name became the American Broadcasting Company, or ABC. So in the last episode, I referred to the fact that RCA pretty much played a role in the creation of three of the major networks mm-hmm. in the United States. It made NBC outright. That was its subsidiary. It inspired the creation of CBS.
Yeah.
And then it spun off half of NBC, which then became ABC.
All right. But also during this time, so Sarnoff was getting military contracts. What did he do with the money?
Well, he was pretty, I mean, not just pretty smart. He was incredibly smart. He used that money to increase RCA's manufacturing capacity. He started building out more manufacturing centers, more factories, because he knew that when the war was at an end, there would be another market for consumer electronics as well as industrial equipment. And in order to meet the need, he would need better manufacturing facilities. So he was using that money. And at the time, they were still making military stuff, but mm-hmm. it was all with the eye of converting this over back to civilian applications once the war was over.
Which they did. So they started making TV sets in 46.
Yes. So war is over. The year after the war is over, RCA starts to really manufacture television sets. Of course, these are black and white TVs at this time. And again, like we've said before, they had to make stuff for people to watch, like those mm-hmm. baseball games. They had to create stuff. So they essentially told NBC, which at the time, again, was just a radio network, to start working into television production as well. So that's when NBC started to become a, not just a radio network, but a TV network. Meanwhile, CBS was trying to do the same thing. William Paley, who was the leader of CBS, he was the guy who had bought CBS mm-hmm. back when it was sort of being made in spite of NBC.
Yes.
So he bought it, and he was also trying to turn CBS into not just a radio network, but a TV network. And Paley would do something very shifty in 1948.
I know what this is. Again, we talked about it in CBS, the Great Talent Raid.
Yes. So in that episode, we mentioned how CBS was able to secure a whole bunch of very big names in radio because the general wisdom was, what's the best way to create really good TV content? Let's take the stuff we make for radio and make it for TV.
And so they already had big radio stars that they could. It's a whole plot point in Singing in the Rain.
Yes. yeah, it's one of those Hollywood stories that has made its way into different tellings yeah. because it was a big deal. So CBS came forward and offered huge contracts, really, really lucrative contracts to stars like George Burns and Gracie Allen, who were a duo at the mm-hmm. time. You had Jack Benny. You had these big, big names in radio who were starting to make the transition to television. And CBS says, why don't you come and work for us for a while? And they said, sure, because these are great contracts.
And NBC was not happy.
No, Sarnoff, he really liked to put his pressure on other companies. He did not like it when the same was done to him.
Yeah.
So he got really upset. And apparently, it really illustrated the difference between Sarnoff's leadership style and philosophy and Paley's leadership style and philosophy. So Sarnoff, reportedly, he hated the idea of advertising. He thought of it as vulgar. He didn't like running ads on his, and he certainly didn't like having to meet with ad executives. That was beneath him. So mm-hmm. he would send direct reports to those meetings. Whereas Paley was like this very gregarious, outgoing guy who was happy to bring people in and have them be part of the whole situation of joining in and having a conversation about how can we get your ads on your network. So Paley was the like polar opposite of Sarnoff.
Yeah. Yeah. But Paley, it seems like Paley won that battle.
He did win that particular battle.
Yeah. All right. So what does RCA do next?
So you remember I told you they had established that movie theater chain
mm-hmm.
and they had created a movie studio, RKO Pictures.
Yes.
And this was all in an effort to get their audio technology into theaters to create the standard. Well, they achieved that. So once they achieved that, they're like, well, there's no reason for us to keep this movie business anymore.
Too much diversification.
So they sold it. And you know they sold it too, because I've got it in the notes.
Howard Hughes.
Yes. Another person we'll have to do an episode about. That'll be a truly eccentric episode. Because when you're that rich, you get to be eccentric.
Okay, so you have this note in 1948 where we get to the Speed Wars, and I'm so excited to hear about how they got into the bus industry.
No, it's not. Yeah, you have to go 55 miles per hour, or it drops below that. RCA explodes.
Yes.
No, this has to everything to do with turntables. All right, I'm going to make this super fast.
Okay, go.
In the beginning, you had turntables that would play music at 78 revolutions per minute. So the discs would turn 78 times every 60 seconds. RCA tried to introduce a 33 and a third RPM album about a decade earlier, but it was during the Great Depression. Nobody bought it. Mm-hmm. Then Columbia, RCA's great rival, comes up with two big things that help change that. First, they start making records out of vinyl as opposed to shellac, which is a much harder material. Vinyl is much easier to work with, and they come up with micro grooves, which means you could fit more grooves per side of the disc, which means more audio.
Yeah, more grooves.
Yeah.
Smooth grooves.
So it used to be that you could only fit like 5 minutes on one side of a 78 album.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to fit way more than that on a 33 and a third album, which was about the same size in dimensions as the old 78s. Now, Columbia said, we're willing to license this design to you, RCA, because you make turntables, you make discs. we'll license this to you. Sarnoff does not like ever having to deal with somebody else's intellectual property. He wants to own it all.
Yeah, or he wants to license it to somebody else.
Exactly. Yeah. He wants to be on the other side of that deal. So Sarnoff says, pound sand, Columbia. And so he creates, he directs RCA to create their own format, which is a 45 RPM album. And they're smaller. They're like, you know, a 7-inch disc as opposed to the 33 and a third, which is like a 12-inch disc.
So it can't hold as much music then.
It can't. It holds about as much as the old 78s do. So this is what would be used for singles, right?
All
you
right.
get a single on one side and then you have the B side, whereas the 33 and a third would create the concept of the long playing or LP album. And you had these two formats going to war with one another. Eventually, you had third-party manufacturers that would make turntables that could work at either speed. So that's what would allow you to play either a 45 or a 33 and a third. You just had to select the right speed. Because I don't know, Ariel, have you ever played with a record player?
I have.
Okay.
I used to have records.
You're younger than I am. I just had to ask.
I know. I didn't know all that technical mumbo-jumbo behind it.
But you know
it's
that—
It's interesting. It's not mumbo-jumbo.
You know that if you put, say, a 45, but you set it to 33 and a third, it's not going to sound right.
No,
it's
going
to be slow and low-pitched. If you put a 33 and a third and you set it to 45, it's going to be like the chipmunks.
Like the chipmunks, yeah.
Yeah. So these were the speed wars, and the two companies would maintain this kind of adversarial approach for the next several years. Ultimately, they would both kind of settle with each other and agree to make – they would agree to make records in the other formats. But it was ugly. Like, these were two big companies that were both vying to become the name in that particular industry.
But, I mean, Columbia Records eventually wins that war, right?
Yeah. I mean, they – 33 and a third became, like, the go-to. And then you would have these singles on 45. So it was kind of this weird world where both were able to coexist. But I think – Columbia, because it created the microgrooves, really had the big advantage. Also, their format came out about a year before RCA's.
And they're also fighting on television, on the television front right
now,
too.
Oh, boy. Yeah, we'll get into that. In fact, let's take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll talk about how Columbia and RCA put up a really good fight on that front.
Okay.
So, we had just talked about how they were going to have this big fight in television. Specifically, it was going to be in setting the standard for color TV. Just as David Sarnoff wanted to set the standard for audio on film, he wanted to set the standard for color television. Now, at first, they started making what were called mechanical color TVs. There was one element inside the television that was on a mechanical basis, not an electronic one. There's literally a color wheel inside the TV sets. This had a disadvantage that I'll get into in a second, but Columbia shows off their version of this, the CBS Columbia version of color TV, and it's a pretty good quality. RCA shows off theirs, and theirs just wasn't quite as good as CBS's. Mm-hmm. So you then have the FCC deciding what's going to be the standard, and they say CBS is going to be the standard because it's a better picture. So we're going to go with CBS's approach to color television.
Oh, Sarnoff, I'm sure, was not super happy.
Not even a little bit. But he had a couple of advantages on his side. One was that he had already been dedicating some resources in RCA to create an electronic version of color TV. It just wasn't ready at the time when the FCC was making this decision. The other advantage was that this mechanical color TV was not compatible with the already existing black and white broadcasts.
Yeah, that is a problem.
Yeah, if you're told, hey, you can buy this brand new TV, sadly, nothing that's showing today will show on your TV, but future shows will if we can sell enough of these. That's not a great— Yeah, you have to convince people that you're going to sell enough to make the content, right? Well, that was not a good enough market proposition for consumers to go out and buy this brand new, very expensive color TV. And at the same time, there was another problem that was coming up. There was the Korean War, mm-hmm. which was making it harder for CBS to even get the components it needed to make its color televisions. It would end up only making a couple hundred, and it just never really took off. Then Sarnoff essentially said, well, I've got this electronic color television solution that was ready a couple years later, shows it to the FCC and says, here's the advantage of mine. You can still watch the old black and white stuff on here because it's using the same methodology. It's just got, if you are able to show it in color, it will show it in color.
Well, and then he made cameras to produce the materials as well.
Yes, and that was another advantage. RCA was in the business of both sides, both the camera side and the screen side. So effectively, RCA would get the color television standard, essentially. There was a committee that was formed, actually technically reformed, the National Television System Committee, NTSC, and they created the standard for color TV, and it was almost exactly RCA's specification.
Yeah, but it still took a long time for color TV to replace black and white TV.
Decades, yeah. It was available. The first RCA set was the CT100, which cost $1,000 in 1954, which would be about 10 grand today.
That's an extra luxury item.
Yeah, no, I can't imagine dropping 10 G's on a television. I can imagine dropping a 10 G television and then immediately wanting to hide somewhere. But anyway, it meant that no one was able to buy one. And because the black and white sets were still good for a while, it wouldn't be until really the 1970s that you started seeing color TV.
I'm guessing they still had to work on their radio side of things as well.
They did. And here's where we get into another dark story and Sarnoff being the ruthless businessman that he was.
All right.
So Sarnoff had a friend, and the effective word there was had a friend named Edwin Howard Armstrong. And Armstrong came up with a methodology for transmitting radio through what was called frequency modulation, or FM. Yeah. Whereas AM, which was the standard, was amplitude modulation. AM has some great advantages. It can go really, really far. Like, those broadcasts can travel great distances, but they can't penetrate through stuff so well. So if you lived in a city, you could have trouble picking up AM stations. FM didn't have those problems, but it had a much smaller range of broadcast. So Armstrong and RCA had worked out an agreement way back when that RCA would get the right of first refusal if Armstrong came up with something that was workable using FM. And Armstrong did. So he goes to RCA and he says, I've got this FM technology. It would require having to invest in all new equipment because FM transmission and AM are not compatible.
Setting up new stations.
Then. Exactly. Yeah, you'd have to build out a whole new infrastructure for this to work, but it will work. So RCA looks at this and says, well, we're really dedicating our resources right now to trying to get television going.
So they refuse.
Yes. Exactly.
So Armstrong can go elsewhere.
Exactly. Yes. You're way ahead of me. Armstrong goes, he makes some agreements with some other folks, and then RCA says, you know what? On second thought, we totally do want that FM thing. But, you know, you gave us the right of first refusal. That's all good. So let's have an agreement where you will license the technology to us royalty-free, so you'll get a flat fee for your technology, but it'll be non-exclusive. So you'll be able to still go to these other parties and use your FM technology
there.
Doesn't
seem fair to the other parties who opted in first.
Yeah, and they were already opted into paying royalties. And Armstrong said, you know, I don't feel good about making that deal because if I say to you, yes, you get this royalty free, whereas everybody else has to pay royalties, that seems like it's not terribly fair. So he said, you know, I don't think this is going to work out. And Sarnoff did not react well to being turned down.
It doesn't seem like he does that very often. Like
Sarnoff liked getting his own way.
Yeah. So he makes his own FM
technology. Yes. He pushes RCA Research and Development to develop their own FM technology. And they wanted to have at least enough plausible deniability to say that they did this completely independently of Armstrong and that none of their technology violated any of the patents that Armstrong held.
That's shifty.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen instances where companies have reverse engineered things and they've made their own version of stuff, and they'll look at a patent and they'll be very careful to try and get the same result without infringing on the patent. But with something like this, it was very questionable that RCA could do this without Armstrong at all. So yeah. Armstrong would end up bringing a lawsuit against RCA, and this lawsuit stretched on for years. And, you know, we talked about how Philo Farnsworth suffered essentially an emotional breakdown due to the length of the legal battle he went through.
Yeah.
It was worse for Armstrong. Not only did his mental health deteriorate, his physical health deteriorated, his wife separated from him after he lost his temper and physically assaulted her.
Golly.
So she leaves him. He, in a deep sense of guilt and shame, takes his own life. And his widow, his estranged wife and now widow, would continue to pursue the lawsuit against RCA, which ultimately settled with her for $1 million, which just happened to be the exact amount that RCA had offered Armstrong in that royalty-free deal.
Golly.
Yeah, so Sarnoff, from what I can understand, never seemed to indicate that he felt he had anything to do with Armstrong's deterioration, but every other source I read outside of Sarnoff seemed to suggest otherwise.
Yeah.
So a very dark portrayal of this particular person.
Yeah. He's still working in the military and scientific areas at this time, right?
Mm-hmm. RCA was still making components for things like electron microscopes. They also contributed components to the United States Ballistic Missile Early Warning System.
Hmm.
I mean, important.
Yeah, yeah. And also to satellites and things
yeah,
like that.
The space race was taking off, and RCA was one of many companies that were contributing components to that. They even created a special division called the RCA Astro Electronics Division, which has an awesome name. And it was also really, well, RCA wasn't like the dominant player in making televisions, but it was the dominant player in making television cameras. And you can't, you know, shoot stuff for television without cameras. So RCA was doing really well on that front. So this was more of a business-to-business kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? Like TV stations were buying these. And keep in mind, like early days of TV, everything was live to broadcast. It was only later that would be, you know, saved to videotape. And so this was an interesting time.
Yeah. Sarnoff's getting old, though.
Yeah. Yeah, he was getting old, and he was getting sick.
Mm.
He started getting health problems. So in 1965, his son Robert would become the president of the company. David Sarnoff was still the chairman of the company, but it was clear that David was sort of, you know, queuing up Robert to become the heir apparent to RCA. And Robert had already served as president of NBC. It's not like he was, you know, sitting at home all the time,
totally
sitting in the giant mansion or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he comes in and he's the president, and then he starts making some decisions that would, you could argue, lead to RCA's eventual decline. So this is where we have our conversation about succession planning.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you keep it in the family, it's not necessarily going to all be wine and roses.
Yeah.
So we get into some diversification and of questionable merit.
So you have a note here, and I skipped over it by accident, that RCA was behind the development of the 8-track tape. That wasn't what brought them down, was it?
No. So the 8-track tape, the consumer side of the 8-track tape had a short life, but 8-track tape in general has had a lot of life outside of those tapes you would find in like an old car. Mm. That nobody listens to anymore. That was not what brought them down. But one thing that really hurt the company was in 65, they started building computers. They got into the computer business. So their first computer was called the Spectra 70. And these were mainframe-type computers, like big centralized computers that would be used for business. So this is, you know, a decade before we get into personal computers. But it was an expensive business to get into. There was already competition from much more grandfathered in companies that had been part of the rise of computers from the beginning.
It seemed like Robert wanted to diversify, but he didn't really put a lot of thought into how.
Or maybe he didn't. Yeah, he didn't consider what the consequences could be if the businesses weren't going so well.
Because I don't think trying to diversify into computers was necessarily the worst idea.
Yeah.
But buying Random House in Hertz?
Yeah. So they bought Random House, the publisher, in 1965. They bought the rental car company Hertz in 1967. In 69, they started fighting against CBS again. They were both CBS and RCA were trying to create a video playback device for the home, essentially a predecessor to what would be the VCR.
Mm-hmm.
So before VHS or Betamax, they were both trying to create something. Spoiler alert, neither of those took off. So both efforts would end up falling short of their goal because the VCR would end up taking that place. So that ended up being a bad business deal as well. And in 1970, David Sarnoff, at age 78, would retire as chairman. And I get the feeling that he didn't want to do it. He did not want to say goodbye. But like we had talked about, since the mid-60s, his health had been in decline. And by this point, he was essentially confined to his home. He could not go to the office. And his doctor, when asked by the board of directors, can Sarnoff continue in his role as chairman, his doctor said, I don't think there's any way he could oversee the day-to-day operations of a company.
Well, they were right, because he passed away
the next year.
The next year.
He turned 80 and then passed away. So he was 78 and 70, but that was early in 1970 when he retired. It was late in 1971 when he passed away, and he was 80 years old. Now, as we have seen in lots of our episodes, when a company loses a leader, and really they had lost Sarnoff, you could argue in 65, right? David Sarnoff had stepped down as president by then. When you lose someone as iconic and as someone whose personality kind of infuses the company's strategy, someone like David Sarnoff, it can often leave a company in a vulnerable position. So how would that turn out for RCA?
I think you said not well.
Oops. Yeah, I think I've already indicated that this does not turn out well. But we'll explain exactly how things went wrong in just a moment. But first, let's take a quick break.
Okay, so after David passed away, RCA wasn't done acquiring things.
Yeah, so this one hits close to home for us, Ariel. They bought a company called Coronet Industries.
Are you calling me a carpetbagger?
No, but I am saying that Coronet Industries had its headquarters in Dalton, Georgia. If you've ever gone up to Dalton, you've passed through to on your way to Tennessee, you see all the billboards for carpet.
Yeah.
That's because of this. It's because of Coronet Industries. So yeah, RCA buys a carpet company, so on top of the rental cars. And then they end up purchasing Banquet Foods, which is known for TV dinners.
Just casting a wide net there.
Mm-hmm. I got to the point where the joke was RCA would stand for rugs, chickens, and automobiles.
Yeah.
So things were not going great from a company culture perspective.
No, but and then they lose their computer division, right?
Yeah, it had been losing money. It was never profitable. They decided to sell it off for a substantial loss to a different company called Universal Automatic Computer, or UNIVAC.
Yeah,
and they hoped that maybe that would get the company back on track, but
it didn't.
No, so RCA was starting to suffer. Its performance was much below what their expectations were based upon their past performance. And they weren't really sure how to run all these businesses they had acquired through Robert Sarnoff's leadership.
Yeah, but they knew how to get rid of the person who kept getting them.
Yeah. So board of directors comes together in 1975 and they say, listen, it's not us, it's you.
It's you.
And they say goodbye to Robert Sarnoff. He effectively is fired from the role of president and chairman. And so then Anthony Conrad, who had been an RCA employee since 1946, would come over and become the new head of RCA.
Yeah, but that's not quite succession planning. And he resigned shortly after.
Yes. Turns out Conrad had made a little bit of a boo-boo. He had failed to report his income taxes for about 5 years in a row. And once that became public knowledge, he felt compelled to step down in September 1976. So essentially, the year after he had become the leader, he has to step down. And then Edgar H. Griffiths would take over RCA. So we've done other episodes where we've talked about rapid changes in, mm-hmm. in leadership that you already are having a problem when your visionary leader has either passed away or retired. Often it's very difficult to continue a company following that vision because the person who was defining it is no longer there. It's even harder when you're going through this rapid change in executive leadership.
But Griffiths at least knew what their issue was with the company, so he started getting rid of all of those very randomly acquired companies.
Yes, he started selling off companies, sold off Banquet Foods. He sold off Hertz rental cars. I think United Airlines bought them. Mm-hmm. He sold off some of the others. However, Coronet Industries, the carpet company, would still be part of RCA.
All right. I mean, he also did some acquisitions, too.
Yeah, he did a $1.3 billion acquisition for a company called Commercial Investment Trust, or CIT. Which was an investment company. Now, CIT also had its own share of odd companies under its owner umbrella, including a furniture company and a greeting card company.
So kind of like two steps forward, three steps back.
Yeah. Now, CIT did get rid of some of those before mm-hmm. the acquisition happened. So it divested itself of some of those companies. But still, it seemed a little odd. Now, that ended up hurting RCA's credit rating as a company. And the board of directors already antsy because of the problems with Robert Sarnoff mm-hmm. and the problems with Conrad. They felt this was not the right spot for RCA, so they demanded that Griffiths hand in his resignation, which he did in 1981.
And then we get Thornton F. Bradshaw.
Yeah, he was an oil tycoon.
Yeehaw.
Yeah, he had also served on the board of RCA,
okay.
so he was already familiar with the operations of the company, and he became the chairman, and then a guy from General Electric named Robert R. Frederick came over and became president of RCA, and they continued to try and shed these subsidiary companies that had been added to RCA.
And they got rid of all of them.
Well, not Coronet Industries, the carpet company, because that sucker stuck
what
around.
The it was,
those carpet tacks are hard to get out.
You know, okay.
Have you ever pulled up carpet? It's hard.
I have, in fact, pulled up carpet.
And you know how hard it is.
I do. Okay.
So imagine how hard it is to get rid of a whole company of that.
It seems like RCA is really floundering at this point.
It was. And so it was weird because on one hand, by divesting itself of all these companies, it actually was cash rich at that point. They had like $2 billion in cash. But that's because they had gotten rid of all these other little companies. So they have $2 billion in cash, but their business isn't doing so well. It's only because they sold all these companies that they have any cash in the first place. And they had really defined a lot of the previous generation's technologies, but in the current generation, things had not been going well, right? They tried to come out with a thing called a capacitance electronic disc or CED player, which did not do well, but I own one. I have one of the few in my house right now next to a couple of different CED discs. By the way, you referenced one of the two movies I own on CED, Singing in the Rain.
Oh,
I have it on CED.
Nice. I was going to say Speed? I didn't think that would be.
No, Speed did not come out on CED. That was, Speed was far after the CED era. But on top of all that, so the corporate leadership had been a real issue for RCA. So that was still a problem for the company. And so this led to a weird situation. General Electric, which, is, as you'll remember, was one of the partners. It was actually the biggest of the partners to, as far as ownership goes, when RCA first came into being.
So a friend.
Yeah. General Electric, the old buddy, comes by and says, "I see you've been having hard times, friend. How about you come into the fold?" General Electric makes a bid to acquire RCA. So RCA has a tough decision to make, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, they've just finished divesting themselves of all these other businesses. They have $2 billion in cash. they are able to now focus on their primary business and hopefully turn it around. Things are starting to look promising, but it's still pretty shaky ground. Do they say yes or no to this deal? Well, if they,
no. They say no.
They thought about it, but here's the problem. This was also in the 80s, and something else was going on in the 80s to a crazy degree.
Bad hair.
Our hair was awesome.
Neon. Lots of neon.
I had hair in the 80s.
Ripped jeans with lace.
Also awesome. I don't see why you're not saying anything wrong so far.
No, I like all those things. Okay.
Boy bands maybe. But anyway, no, in the 1980s, there was this culture of hostile takeovers in business. And a hostile takeover is when a company goes in to acquire another company. They can't do it through normal acquisition. So they appeal to shareholders and they essentially try to get more shares of the company, like a controlling interest amount of shares, like 51% of ownership of the company. And then they effectively can tell the board of directors to go.
Yeah.
Take a long walk up.
It's a workaround to get your own way.
Yeah. So the board of RCA said, well, we could say no to this deal, but that would potentially set up a hostile takeover situation, and then we'd have to defend ourselves from GE. And that would be a lengthy and expensive, and ultimately it could be an unsuccessful task. Or we could agree to the acquisition.
So they agree.
Yes. And that $2 billion in cash was actually a strike against RCA, which seems counterintuitive. But the reasoning was this. If GE were to go after RCA for a hostile takeover, they could go after RCA super hard because if they took over RCA, then they would get that $2 billion and they could use that to pay off any debts that they accrued in the process of going after RCA.
Well, thankfully, they didn't have to do that. They only spent $6.4 billion.
Yes, they just bought RCA outright at $6.4 billion. And this is why I say that RCA effectively stopped being a company in 1986, because General Electric would bring RCA under the fold, so it's no longer an independent company at all, and then either liquefied and sold off RCA assets or consolidated RCA assets with existing General Electric or GE assets. So all the divisions of RCA that weren't sold off became part of other existing GE divisions.
I like this note you have about RCA Records, because they were sold off. They didn't become a part of GE.
Right. Yes. So GE did sell off, like I said, some of the components, one of those being RCA Records. RCA Records is what had evolved essentially from the Victor Talking Machine Company, Victor Records. We had talked about them in the previous episode. So RCA Records is the one that has Nipper as the in the logo.
Yes, yes.
They got sold off to a company called the Bertelsmann Music Group, better known as BMG. Mm-hmm. So BMG buys RCA Records. But then BMG would merge with Sony Music in 2004.
Isn't Sony the parent company of Columbia Records?
Yeah. So RCA and Columbia, which had been the fiercest of competitors in the old gramophone days and the speed wars of the figuring out the album speed, now belong to the same company. It's similar to, I think we've talked about this with board games and toys as well, right? Like, there were toy companies that were in fierce competition with each other that now ultimately belong to the same parent company.
Well, it certainly seems it's like that old adage they said about the thunderstorm, the faster it comes on, the faster it goes away. It seems like RCA grew really strong and really hard and really fast, and then
fizzled out.
had a mighty fall.
It did that over the course of almost 80 years. So it was a good long run, and really 70 years. And while RCA the brand calls this its centennial, that's 100 years old. You could make the argument that the brand has very little connection to the company that gave it its name.
Yeah.
Because it's just gone through so many different changes in ownership. Either it's, there are RCA branded products out there, there are RCA records out there, but it's like it's a flavor. It's not like it belongs to the same lineage necessarily as this established company that came together in 1919.
Well, it certainly is a very interesting and dramatic story.
Yes, it's a phenomenal one. You know, again, to see a company that I would say RCA was one of those that you would describe too big to fail at its height. Yeah. And
like the Titanic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was
Sarnoff got the distress signal from.
Exactly. In 1912. That's a good callback. Yeah. It was established as a monopoly by the United States government. And then ultimately it had to be swallowed up by one of the companies that helped establish it in the first place.
Yeah.
I think really you could, in retrospect, lay a lot of this at the decline of health of David Sarnoff and the fact that Robert Sarnoff, while he was ambitious and was trying to diversify the company's holdings in order to give it more stability, but it just didn't work out.
He just went too random. He went too far and wide.
And probably didn't have quite the same force of will as his father did. And that's not to say that David – I don't think I would like David Sarnoff very much.
It's not necessarily saying it's a bad thing.
Yeah. For the purposes of establishing a corporate empire, it might not work out so well.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that I would find David Sarnoff to be not my kind of person. Not to say like he's necessarily good or bad, but some of the decisions he made are ones that would be very difficult for me to reconcile.
I agree with that. But that is all we have in RCA.
Yes.
So if you guys have any companies you want us to talk about, email them to us, you know, or you can just email to say hi. We do get all of those suggestions and we are working through them.
Yes, we have an actual spreadsheet that Ariel maintains that has all the different suggestions and who made them. And we are thankful for all of them. Keep them coming in because it's awesome. It lets us know exactly what you guys want to hear about. And otherwise, it's Ariel and I just sitting down and saying, so what's a company you know?
Yeah. So if you have those companies or you just want to say hi, email us at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show.
Yep. And you can pop to our website. That's thebrinkpodcast.show. That's where there's an archive of all of our past episodes. There's some information about your beloved hosts who beloved you right back.
Yes.
And until next time, I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Ariel Kasten. Business on the Brink is a production of iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.